Hello and welcome to edition number 2115 of the Whitney Talking News, which we are recording on Thursday the 2nd of July 2026 at the High Street Methodist Church in Whitney. I'm Alan Revell, your editor this week, and yes, it was my voice that you heard as editor last week too. Beside me at the recording controls is Peter Brading, and this week our four readers are Valerie T., John Ashwell, Valerie Palmer and Robert Buckingham. We're grateful to the Whitney Gazette for many of the items we're using, as well as the Chipping Norton News. We will begin with Valerie, T that is, and a story from the Gazette, which requires no further explanation, I think.
It's quite a worrying headline. Gas pipe warning sparks police emergency response. A man threatened to blow up a property where he was living by pulling out a gas pipe, a court heard. Leonard Trinard, 38, of Westfield Road, Whitney, was sentenced at Oxford Crown Court after admitting threats to damaged property and of criminal damage. The offences took place on March the 16th this year, when police attended the property where Trinder was living at the time. The court heard this was just 1 week after he had been handed a 20-week prison sentence, suspended for 18 months, for three counts of using threatening language. Isabella Glendinning, prosecuting, told the court that when the police attended, Trinder was highly agitated and refused to exit. He made threats to officers that he would pull out the gas pipe and blow up the property. Police took this threat seriously and turned the gas off. Trinder also smashed a window at the property and cut off his electronic tag and threw it out of the window. He also threatened to harm officers with needles and shards of glass, saying he'd give them HIV. He also set fire to some curtains. Trinder eventually left the property through a window and was arrested. Miss Glendinning told the court that Trinder made full admissions in police interview and accepted responsibility. She said, "This was a serious threat about the gas, but this was a moment of real instability for the defendant. He only intended to harm himself." The court heard that Trinder has 43 previous convictions for 85 offences. Kelly Enover, mitigating, said he's been clean from drugs for 12 months. Speaking to the judge, Trinder said, "I got clean off drugs, but I started drinking. I didn't have a care for myself." Miss Enover added, "He needs to deal with his root offending issue, which is alcohol. He needs to engage with services. It's an opportunity for him. Otherwise, he will keep coming to court." Judge Hassan Khan said, "I'm going to give you a further opportunity. You committed these offences 7 days after the suspended sentence was imposed." Trinder was handed a 12-month prison sentence, suspended for 2 years. This includes 23 rehabilitation activity requirement days and an alcohol treatment requirement for 12 months. The suspended sentence was activated, but as Trinder had been in custody since March the 17th, the judge considered that to have been served already.
And now it's time for our reflection, which this week comes from the Reverend Sue Jacobs, and we are giving her more time than is usual for reasons which will become self-evident.
So I'm still buzzing with joy as the Sunday that just passed was Ordination Sunday for me. I'm not really sure I can put any of the last week into words. I was sent on my pre-ordination retreat, which was a true gift. And from there, I went to meet up with my most favourite people as I was received into full connection of the Methodist Church and ordained. When the church says it's giving you a gift, you're never quite sure what you're going to receive. So to hear that retreat was a gift left me a little bit sceptical, perhaps a little wondering. I arrived at Cliff College in the beautiful Peak District to be greeted by other ministers, colleagues along the journey, and those who had been in ministry for a long time. Of course, it was the midst of the heat wave, so walking in the Peak District was slightly limited on what we had planned. but we use the time to pray together, to read scripture together, just to be. The whole theme of the week was being. And then we chose that at sunrise, when the day was cooler, to walk to the top of Hope Valley Cliff. And there, as Ordinands, we stood looking over the edge with what seemed like the world ahead of us. I like to talk a lot, but in that moment, I was completely silent and awestruck by the beauty of God that was before me. Foolishly, of course, if you climb a cliff to the top at sunset, you have to come down in the dark, and only one Wally fell over into the stinging nettles. I wonder who that might be. Having been away from my family for 5 days then on retreat, we were reunited in Telford, where the Methodist Church held its conference this year. We were greeted with great excitement. The babies, the new ministers had arrived. We were received with the warmth and love of what we in the Methodist Church call our beloved connection. On Sunday morning, it was a very, very early start, not only because we had a cockerel in the farmhouse next to us, but because the conference required us to be there early for a kit check to make sure our shoes were shiny and our dog collars straight before we had a walkthrough of the first ceremony. At that ceremony, we were welcomed by the president of the Methodist Conference, who spoke to us about having a heart for justice. And there the conference said, yes, we agree that these people are worthy of ordination. We danced down the aisle after such great affirmation and made our way to Shrewsbury Abbey, where the ordinations were to take place. They kept us ordinands behind a screen with our assisting ministers, so we couldn't see how busy the abbey was becoming. I think that was a lot for our nerves. As we processed out, it was a delight to see the faces of the communities that we served, of the people that we loved, standing before us. Some real highs of that service were to hear the voices of those present acclaiming that we were worthy, something I think all of us had questioned in the 6 years of training that had gone before. We were claimed worthy. We were prayed for with the laying on of hands. We were presented a Bible as a charge to go and preach the gospel to all those that we meet. And then we received an applause like no other applause. It felt like the 950-year-old building in which we found ourselves was applauding with us. It felt like a cloud of saints and witnesses were affirming the work that we had been ordained to. And so we almost danced down the aisle in great celebration, where the hugging began and continued for the rest of a very emotional day that reminded us that God is always in control.
Well, you can tell from Sue's voice how exciting that weekend was for her. Thank you, Sue, for recounting that uplifting time with us.
You're welcome.
So my first mistake this evening, and hopefully the last, was to say that John Ashwell was one of our readers this week. In fact, it's Henry Spielberg. And Henry, has a report about a court ruling that may stop activists from flying flags.
And the headline is, Council wins court battle to get flags off lampposts. Raise the Colours activists have agreed to stop raising England flags after a court battle. Ryan Bridge, Ben Cullen and Trudy Wells, as well as Kevin Good, who did not attend court, have said they will no longer put flags up on lampposts in Oxfordshire. Oxfordshire County Council brought legal action against the group at the High Court, winning a ruling to stop people raising flags near highways, saying it involved safety risks as well as trespass and obstruction. The widespread flying of Union and St George's Cross flags, following an online campaign called Operation Raise the Colours, has become contentious, and several local authorities have removed them from public infrastructure. While some politicians criticised the removals, others claimed the increased number being flown was a result of xenophobia or racism. The County Council said flags had been placed on or near public roads without permission for months, despite a formal legal notice in March and pre-action legal letters sent to individuals last month. Robin Green, for the council, told the High Court that Mr. Bridge, Mr. Cullen, Mr. Good and Ms. Wells had been involved. After a short hearing, where the group represented themselves, they agreed not to put up more flags, not to encourage others to do so, and not to obstruct any council worker or contractor taking them down. Mr. Justice Dexter Dias set another hearing for July the 9th to be attended by anyone wishing to oppose a court order stopping anyone else from putting up flags or obstructing staff. Mr. Green, for the council, said, "It is the council's case that no authorisation had been given to the named defendants, or indeed anyone else, to attach flags to lampposts, lighting columns or any other highway structure, so where that has been done, we say it is an offence." He said the council had also wished to pursue an injunction against the named group, but would be happy for them to make a formal undertaking to the court. Mr. Bridge said, "I feel it is a sad day for the flag of our country and what it represents." Ms. Wells, who told the court that she had never put up any flags, but was said to have encouraged others online, added, "I'm not going to have anything to do with the flags anymore. It's not worth it." Council leader Tim Bearder said previously, "We proudly fly the Union flag and St. George's flag at County Hall, and we fully support the right of residents to display flags on their own private property. However, there's an important distinction between lawful expression and activity that puts people at risk or intimidates residents in their own communities."
And now it's our other Valerie Palmer, with a report about giving the public the chance to have their say about two town markets.
Yes, this is headlined, "New Survey Seeks Input on Quality of Town Markets." West Oxfordshire District Council have announced the launch of a new public survey designed to gather feedback on the charter markets at Witney and Chipping Norton from residents, businesses and market visitors. The council aims to gain a better understanding of people's experiences of the markets since the appointment of operator Cotswold Markets last year. The survey consists of questions ranging from the market's cleanliness and overall atmosphere to variety, quality and price of available produce. Responses will help the council and market operators identify opportunities for improvement. Council Deputy Leader and Executive Member for Economic Development, Duncan Enright, said, "Since the appointment of Cotswold Markets, we want to hear from residents about what is working well and what they would like to see. This is an opportunity for us to build on what makes our markets unique and special, helping them continue to thrive for local visitors, local people, visitors and businesses alike. Witney Charter Market takes place every Thursday and Saturday in Market Square, while Chipping Norton Charter Market is held every Wednesday on the High Street. The survey, which is available online, only takes a few minutes to complete. It will remain open until 12 p.m. on Monday the 13th of July."
And completing this first round of reports, it's Robert with a story about a key service at risk in a West Oxfordshire town.
Yes, the headline is "Post Office Couple to Quit After Council Rent Dispute." A popular post office is set to close after a popular couple who run it vowed to leave after a council rent spat. Rana and Sworn Lally, who run the Woodstock post office and community shop, have said that they will not renew their lease in 2028 after an argument with the town council about the Park Street property. The pair are popular figures within the community and have been running the post office for more than two decades. The dispute came about in early June, when Woodstock Town Council reportedly attempted to significantly hike the rent for the post office building, which it owns, although the council has denied this. A petition was organised against the move, which said our post office is a valued local service that provides essential facilities for residents, businesses and visitors. It was signed by over 230 people and handed to the town council. By this time, an extraordinary town council meeting had been held on Tuesday, June the 16th, which was controversially kept confidential. After it, a new deal was agreed with Mr. and Mrs. Lye. Both the post office shop and the flat above would be separated into two distinct units. The former will be retained by Mr. and Mrs. Lally, with a £2,000 increase to £13,000 per annum, while the latter will be rented out at a different party. Mr. Lally said, "I'm quite happy with the deal." However, on the council's conduct, he was less than satisfied. "The way they've gone about this," he said, "I do not want to be their tenants anymore, and I will not renew the lease of this property." The 68-year-old added, "Nobody from the council informed me about what was going on. All I got was emails from an estate agent. A few nights, we had no sleep. When the immediate future of the post office was in doubt, multiple members of the community spoke out about the potential tragedy." Lady Mary Stubbs said it would be disastrous. She said it is a significant part of Woodstock and the people who run it are wonderful. "It's important, it's accessible to elderly people. You can get your currency there before you go away. It meets the needs of a huge number of people. It would be a tragedy if it were to go." A local businesswoman added, "Everyone knows the couple and it'd be a huge loss to the town. People who come to Blenheim use it. It's a big part of what keeps the town vibrant." Speaking about the reaction of the community, Mr. Lally thanked the local people and said it was absolutely brilliant.
The headline here is "Asylum Seekers Removed from Hotel in Barracks Bid." The government has been accused of trying to appeal to reform supporters by closing Witney's Asylum Seekers Hotel and moving refugees to a former army barracks. Charlie Maynard, MP for Witney, criticised the Home Office after it announced the Oxford Witney Hotel on Ducklington Lane has been closed to refugees, one of 20 such sites across the country to be shut. Instead, the government is looking to use former military barracks to house thousands of asylum seekers, including the former Bicester garrison. It is believed the Home Office plans to house 1,250 people at the redundant Site A at MOD Bicester between Piddington and Upper Arncott from next year. Mr. Maynard called the announcement a lame attempt to copy reform and a recipe for disaster. He said, "The government needs to be much more effective at controlling our borders and much faster at processing people who do arrive. We should be taking a leaf out of Canada's book," he added, "which has various successful programs, including enabling local communities to sponsor, help and integrate people more directly." On the closure of the Oxford Whitney Hotel, the Liberal Democrat said he was deeply impressed with the conduct of the community and how many had helped to make life easier for the people staying there. "That includes schools, health centres, churches," he said, "and many, many community groups who have done such a great job." Figures from the Home Office stated that there were 124 asylum seekers living in the West Oxfordshire district as of June the 30th, 2025, many of them likely to be in the hotel. Its use for housing asylum seekers has been controversial, with representatives across the political spectrum critical. The leader of the Oxfordshire Conservatives welcomed the recent news. Liam Walker said, "This arrangement was never intended to be permanent, and many local residents have consistently raised concerns about the impact on the local community and the lack of consultation." However, he explained, moving the asylum seekers to former military sites and houses of multiple occupancy would not solve the wider problem. The asylum system remains far too slow, he said, and the government needs to get a grip of it by processing claims much more quickly, removing those with no right to remain and ensuring local communities are properly consulted before accommodation is identified. Duncan Enright, leader of the Labour and Cooperative Group on West Oxfordshire District Council, said he hoped the hotel could be used for tourists once more.
Well, this story is headlined, Fleet of RAF Planes to be Moved. Stansted Airport is to be a temporary base for RAF planes while work is carried out at Brize-Norton. RAF Brize-Norton is set to undergo essential resurfacing and improvement works leading to temporary airfield closure. The Ministry of Defence confirmed the planned modernisation programme aims to keep the base fully operational for decades. All airfield operations and flights will be temporarily relocated to various other UK locations. An MOD spokesman said, members of the public living near RAF Brize-Norton or near dispersal locations may notice increased activity at some sites during this period. This is entirely planned and expected. The Atlas and Globemaster fleets will primarily operate out of MOD Boscombe Down, with occasional flights from Bournemouth Airport. Meanwhile, the A330 Voyager fleet will operate from Prestwick, East Midlands and Stansted airports. Aircraft usually based at RAF Brize-Norton will start moving to their temporary locations in July, with an expected return in late November when resurfacing has been completed. RAF Brize-Norton serves as the UK's main military air mobility hub, playing a crucial role in the movement of personnel, equipment and humanitarian supplies worldwide. The MOD said the improvement works form part of a long-term investment in defence infrastructure, directly supporting the UK's capability to swiftly respond to emerging threats and crises globally. The MOD said the airfield improvement works are part of a wider programme to modernise RAF Brize-Norton, ensuring it continues to serve as a world-class hub for UK air mobility for decades to come. This is defence delivering value for money through transformation and infrastructure investment. And the article is accompanied by a photograph of a Boeing Globemaster C-17 parked up at Brize-Norton with its crew standing by.
And this article is entitled, 8 Charged with Drug Offences After Raid. 8 people have been charged with drug offences after a massive raid involving 150 officers across the county. Thames Valley Police executed warrants across Oxfordshire last Tuesday to complete drugs raids in properties in Oxford, Bicester, Whitney and Abingdon, where cocaine, heroin and cannabis were found. 7 men and 1 woman have been charged with drug offences, including conspiracy to supply Class A drugs in a huge bust by around 150 police officers. Sian Yasser, 30, of Castle Street in Bicester, Mohammed Ali, 25, of Flaxfield Road in Oxford, Ari Shaho, 26, of Gladstone Road in Oxford, and Abdullah Mohammed, 30, of Abingdon Road in Oxford, have each been charged with 3 counts. Darren Holden, 38, of Highworth Place, Whitney, and Jamie Lamont Holden, 20, of Girdleston Road, Headington, have each been charged with 1 count of conspiracy to supply Class A drugs. Rafakat Hussein, 48, of Rose Hill, Oxford, was charged with 2 counts of conspiracy to supply Class A drugs. Nicola Ford, 58, of Clement Street, Oxford, was charged with 1 count each of conspiracy to supply Class A drugs, namely cocaine, and conspiracy to supply Class B drugs. Riaset Shaho, Mohammed, Holden, Lamont Holden, Ali, Hussein and Ford have been remanded to appear at High Wycombe Magistrates Court today.
Now on a happier note, the headline is Family Bakers Open Cafe at Brewery Site. Blake's Kitchen, a third-generation family-run bakery and cafe, which opened a branch in Witney. This month's opening was attended by the town's mayor, Ian Doughty, and MP Charlie Maynard. Known for its handmade sourdough cinnamon buns and warm, quality-driven cafe experience, Blake's has transformed the 100-year-old Witchwood Brewery site at the Eagle Industrial Estate near the Green into a new bakery and cafe restaurant. The decision to expand was driven by the success of its original Clanfield site. Nicola Cooper, founder and bakery director at Blake's, said, "Put simply, we outgrew our original bakery. It's been bursting at the seams for some time as we expanded our cafe sites and wholesale offering, and with no space to grow further there, we've been looking for a new site close to our original home." And we've got a lovely picture of two lovely ladies. One is the general manager, Laura Cottrell. The other is deputy manager, Sophie Green. And they're very smiling, happy faces in T-shirts with Blake's Kitchen blazoned on them and lots of nice-looking pastries in front of them.
Firefighters warn of dangers of river swims. Firefighters are warning of the dangers of entering open water during hot weather. A recent training exercise in Burford gave the Burford crew the chance to talk to the public about water safety as temperatures reached 32 degrees centigrade. The crew used the opportunity to remind people of the risks associated with entering rivers or lakes, particularly during periods of high heat. "With high temperatures, we took the time to speak with adults, families and young people about the risk of entering bodies of water during high heat," a spokesman at Burford Station said. "With an outside temperature of 32 degrees centigrade and a river temperature of 18 degrees centigrade, although inviting, suddenly entering the water can cause cold water shock, and a large intake of breath could cause water to be brought into the lungs. The warning follows multiple fatalities in rivers and open water across Europe over the past month. The crew is urging the public to remain vigilant and to closely supervise children and young people around water. Burford Fire Station is also currently recruiting for a minimum of 8 new on-call firefighters. The paid role offers flexibility and fits around other work and personal commitments."
I've now got three short items of news in brief. First one headed, "Missing person found with help of drone." Police officers used new technology during a search, then located a stolen car on the same shift. Thames Valley Police's Rural Crime Task Force were out in the Witney area last Wednesday. PCs Little and Carney Smith safely found a high-risk missing person using a drone. Later on in the shift, they located a Toyota RAV4 just outside Northampton, following intelligence sharing from the Driver and Vehicle Licensing Agency. The vehicle, which was stolen last year, was confirmed to be on cloned plates. Unfortunately, it had been sold on to an unsuspecting buyer who had done all the right checks prior to buying it. An investigation is now underway to identify suspects. The second story is new benches installed at Lake and Country Park. Witney Town Council has announced the installation of 5 new benches across Witney Lake and Country Park. 3 have been added around Mill Meadow, with 2 placed near Witney Lake. There are plans for 2 more to join them as soon as operationally possible, the Town Council has promised. The benches, made of recycled plastic and designed to resemble the style of pre-existing benches, represent another positive development for the 37-acre park after it was designated a local wildlife centre in recognition of its ecological importance and biodiversity. And lastly, have your say at policing teams events. Thames Valley Police are set to host a range of Have Your Say events in West Oxfordshire over the coming week. These public sessions will give residents an opportunity to speak with their neighbourhood policing teams and raise concerns about antisocial behaviour as part of Antisocial Behaviour Awareness Week, running until July the 5th. Sessions will be held outside ASDA in Carterton on Friday, July the 3rd, from 10 a.m. till noon, followed by the Lees in Whitney on Saturday, July the 4th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m, and at Woodstock Town Hall on Sunday, July the 5th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Residents are encouraged to share their concerns.
And this is entitled Lib Dems Regain Majority on County Council. The Liberal Democrats have regained their majority on Oxfordshire County Council. Ben Higgins, a county councillor for Watlington and Rotherfield, has rejoined the political group, having stepped down in May. He had been the cabinet member for Future Economy and Innovation, but left the role in unknown circumstances. Following his reconnection with the group, the Liberal Democrats now have 35 councillors on the 69-member authority. Labour have 12, Conservatives 10, Greens 7 and 5 others. I'm delighted that we will be in a stronger position to deliver on our policies for the people of Oxfordshire, said County Council leader Tim Bearder. With Ben's support, we will continue to deliver record levels of investment in our local communities, to fix the mess we inherited from the Conservatives, and to campaign against the Labour government's plan to slash £24 million from the County Council budget. At a time when we seem to have perpetual chaos at Westminster, this will provide stability so that we can get on with the job. Mr. Higgins has lived in Oxfordshire most of the last 25 years. He's a successful businessman, having founded and grown an energy efficiency business based in the county.
Now the first of two stories on changes to our roads. The headline is 60 mile an hour speed limit reductions examined. Widespread 60 mile an hour Oxfordshire speed limit reductions are being reviewed by the County Council on dozens of rural roads. Oxfordshire County Council has said that it is examining all the county's A and B roads with dozens of bespoke reductions in the offing. Gareth Epps, Cabinet Member for Transport, said, "This review is all about reducing deaths and serious injuries on our roads. The premise that no one should be killed or seriously injured as a result of a road collision, whatever the mode of transport they are using, is at the heart of our Vision Zero strategy. Making sure speed limits are safe and appropriate is the key to achieving this. Oxfordshire's last major A and B road speed limit review was carried out 15 years ago, so this review is much needed. The examination speed limits and the safety has been ongoing since 2025, looking into whether existing measures are appropriate, using evidence such as collision data, road layout and how routes are used. This has already led to reductions on some roads, including lowering national speed limit sections from 60 miles an hour to 50 miles an hour or 40 miles an hour. Other measures include junction changes or traffic management, with the aim of being to ensure rural roads are safe for all users, recognising that many are narrow, winding and shared by drivers, cyclists, walkers and horse riders. The County Council has said that government data shows that its policies have led to significant improvements in road safety, with serious and fatal collisions falling sharply. However, despite this, Mr. Epps said they were being far from complacent. He added, "Every death is one too many. Indeed, it has strengthened our resolve to push on and make conditions safer on more of our rural roads." So far, the review has led to changes being approved on stretches of the A4074, the A40, the A420, the A417, as well as corridors such as the A4260 and associated B roads. Additionally, a consultation on changing the A361 has been completed, with a decision to be taken in July on whether to progress with these. Now around 60 more schemes are coming forward in the 2026-27 as part of the Vision Zero programme. Stakeholder consultation will begin later this month, including with parish and town councils, Thames Valley Police and bus operators. This will be followed by strategy consultation later in the year, where the public will be invited to have their say. Mr. Epps continued, "It is important for these people to realise that the review is not about introducing blanket changes across the county. This is a bespoke approach. Proposals are assessed case by case, consulted on publicly and monitored once implemented to ensure that they are effective."
And now another article about roads. 11 local roads to be quiet lanes. Oxfordshire County Council has published a list of 11 quiet lane requests where the majority of cars will soon be banned. Roads include Bagley Wood Road, often used as a cut-through from the Oxford Road from Abingdon to Kennington, requested by Kennington Parish Council. Sunningwell Road and or Green Lane was requested to become a quiet lane by Sunningwell Parish Council. In nearby Radley, Slugworth Lane, Kennington Road to Oxford Road, is also set to be a quiet lane, as requested by the village parish council. Other roads include Lower Road and Station Road in Blackthorn, east of Bicester, requested by its parish, and the road through Bainton, that's the B4100, to Stratton Audley Road at Stoke Lyne and Caversfield. The road from Hanwell to Great Boughton near Banbury. Hanwell Lane has also been requested by Liberal Democrat councillor Chris Brandt. Evenload Lane in Fawler, West Oxfordshire, roads connecting Towersey to the B445 and the A4129 in South Oxfordshire, Battle Road in Goring and Kingston Hill in Aston Rowant take the list of requests to 11, all submitted by the respective parishes. Going forward, Oxfordshire County Council said each application will now be assessed using a standard method to ensure decisions are transparent, consistent, and evidence-led. This is part of a seven-stage implementation process which includes local engagement and a cabinet member decision before a pilot is trialled, followed by a statutory consultation to monitor the impact and help in final decision-making, it said. Shepherd's Pit Lane in Stanton St John is expected to be the first pilot later this summer, following feedback from the public. Gates and bollards will be used to block general traffic from accessing the roads, and Oxfordshire County Council says its pilot is an enhancement to Department for Transport policy, going beyond traditional signage-based lanes to achieve the safest outcomes. Gareth Epps, Cabinet Member for Traffic on Oxfordshire County Council, said quiet lanes will make roads safer and encourage sustainable travel. "Before any sites are trialled, we will expect to see dialogue with local residents and other stakeholders, including businesses such as farms, to understand potential impacts and help to decide whether to continue developing an individual quiet lane. If a quiet lane does go ahead as a trial, changes can be made and there will be a public consultation to gather feedback. As part of the pilot programme, we would not consider a quiet lane on a road where there is a bus route."
The headline is Remembrance Walk to Support Hospice. A remembrance walk will take place in West Oxfordshire. Walk in Their Memory is open to anyone who has experienced loss. Organised by Helen and Douglas House, the event will take place at Cogs Manor Farm in Whitney on Saturday, July the 11th at 3pm. One of those already signed up to take part is Sam McCartney, whose son Hudson died in May 2024 at just a few weeks old. The family were referred to Helen and Douglas House, where the whole family, mum, dad and Hudson's siblings, have received specialist bereavement support. This is the family's second time attending the event. The event is free, but donations are encouraged to help Helen and Douglas House, which relies almost entirely on public donations to fund its work. And there's a very nice photo of the whole McCartney family. There's five adults, two children and a baby in a pushchair, and they're all wearing T-shirts with the image of Hudson on them.
And this is entitled Churchill's Boxes Set to Go Under the Hammer. Four boxes with direct provenance to Sir Winston Churchill or his offices are up for sale and expected to sell for up to £215,000 at auction. The pieces will be sold next week by Christie's. The auction house said that items offer a tangible link to the man and the moments that shaped him, his celebrated career and his enduring legacy. The group is led by a prime ministerial dispatch box, which is recorded as having been used by Sir Winston circa 1940, during Britain's darkest hour. It sits alongside a humidor given to the wartime prime minister by US President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Christie's has said the item encapsulates not only the single most important alliance in the Allied victory in the Second World War, but also Churchill's much-famed love of cigars. The collection also includes a 1915 dispatch box from Sir Winston's period as Chancellor to the Duchy of Lancaster, and a tin deed box inscribed with his name, which also dates from this earlier period in his career. Born at Blenheim Palace, Sir Winston Churchill served as soldier and statesman under six British monarchs, from Queen Victoria to Queen Elizabeth. Christie's said the four boxes illustrate the pivotal moments of Churchill's political career, spanning his time in government through both the First and Second World Wars. The first dispatch box, which is embossed with Prime Minister, is expected to sell for between £70,000 and £100,000. It has been documented as being used by Sir Winston while serving as Prime Minister between 1940 and 1945. This box is said to have been among those delivered to him daily, where it would have contained vital papers relating to the war, as well as cabinet, foreign and Commonwealth documents requiring his immediate attention. It was previously held in the collection of the Foreign Office. Christie's said the box represents an incredibly rare piece of political history, as prime ministerial boxes almost never come to public auction. The humidor was initially given to Mr. Roosevelt by Cuban President Fulgencio Batista before the US President passed it on to Sir Winston, who had a well-known love of cigars. It is set to sell for between £25,000 and £40,000.
And we've got a lovely picture here, a photograph of a Shih Tzu puppy coming straight forward towards the camera. And its headline is "Abandoned Puppies Will Find Loving Homes." Seven puppies left under a bush when they were just a month old have now been found new homes thanks to the national pet charity Blue Cross. The Shih Tzu puppies named Bernie, Tilly, Hetty, Betsy, Harold, Sandy and Norman by staff at the charity's rehoming centre at Shilton Road, Burford, were transferred into Blue Cross care after being found by a member of the public and taken to the Oxfordshire Animal Sanctuary. When the puppies arrived, they were still needing their mother's milk and required bottle feeding from the charity's dedicated team. The puppies were found abandoned under a bush in Abingdon in March. Anushka Ashmead Bartlett, admissions coordinator at Blue Cross Burford, said, "It's a good thing they were discovered when they were and brought into safety, as they are unlikely to have survived on their own." Following successful treatment, the pups, aged 6 weeks, have all been found new homes.
Well, that wraps up our first part of the programme, and now it's the editor's choice of articles, and I'm calling this A Tale of Two Captains. What a great win by England's footballers on Wednesday, inspired by their captain Harry Kane, whose two goals rescued a match against the unfancied Democratic Republic of Congo. What a contrast to England's cricket team. Last Sunday, four of us drove to Trent Bridge in Nottingham for the fourth day of the third and deciding test match between England and New Zealand. We were pretty excited. My brother-in-law had secured some tickets in the Radcliffe Road stand, which thankfully is a distance from another stand where the Barmy Army were seated. By way of explanation, the Barmy Army are a self-identifying cabal of England fans who follow the team around the country and indeed the world. The day didn't go particularly well for England on the field. The bowlers struggled to take wickets as the Kiwis ground out a formidable lead to declare and leave England a tough task when it came their turn to bat. The target was 373 runs, which meant England would need to achieve a record score for a fourth innings at Nottingham. Unlikely, but not impossible. Well, until the England captain Ben Stokes took leave of his senses. Bizarrely, Stokes had unexpectedly decided to retire from cricket while the players were in the pavilion for the tea interval, probably because the shock news of his intention had already leaked and the BBC had posted it online. So most of the ground already knew that he was quitting before the ground announcer told them. But his other news was that Stokes would be opening the batting in this, his last England innings. Now, Stokes normally bats at number 6 or number 7, but on Sunday he'd promoted himself up the order and employed every unorthodox shot in the book, and some not in it, to slog a 4 or a 6, or, inevitably, miscue a shot straight to a fielder. Out then for 30 runs off just 20 balls. Just as bizarrely, the next few England batsmen came and went in similar style, and at close of play, four of them were out for not many runs, and the chances of a win had all but vanished. As I left the ground, a number of the Barmy Army, one who told me he'd drunk 10 beers that afternoon, were talking loudly about what fun it had been. I couldn't help but disagree. And I told them it was shameful that they had taunted the New Zealand batsman Darryl Mitchell with chants of boring, boring Mitchell all afternoon as he patiently amassed a century to put his team in the box seat. We drove home via a curry house, somewhat deflated, and the day's events were picked over. We'd all seen some drama at a cricket ground over the years, but none of us had seen a team led by its captain seemingly throw away a match with no regard for fans like us who'd paid £65 for a ticket, £10 to park, £40 for fuel and £7.60 for a pint of beer. The English Cricket Board needed to respond, and yesterday they did, not to us, but by sacking their managing director Rob Key. The next task is to find another captain. Perhaps Harry Kane can play cricket. And next, it's quiz time. First, the answers to last week's quiz, which was also set by me. I invite our readers here tonight to shout out the answers. First question was, since David Cameron's departure after the Brexit referendum, Britain has had 5 prime ministers. Can you name them? Anybody around the table?
May. Johnston.
Johnson. Truss. Sunak. Starmer.
Exactly right. Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer. Question two was, the likely new Prime Minister, this was last week and still is the case today, is Andy Burnham. For which city was he mayor before his recent election as an MP?
Manchester.
Technically Greater Manchester, but I'll give you all Manchester. Question three was, last Friday the UK reached a new record June temperature. What was the new high? Anybody know?
34.8.
Well, it's almost 38, according to the news, anyway. I didn't know the answer myself at the time of recording, because the latest new high, 37.7, was recorded the next day, on Friday the 26th of June. Question four. Thomas Tuchel was the manager of which English Premier League football club before taking over as England manager? Anybody know? No football fans in the room, except me. It was Chelsea Football Club. And my final question last week was, the Wimbledon Tennis Championships were to start on Monday. That's Monday this week. Who won the men's singles title last year, and what is his nationality?
Sinner, and he's Italian.
Very, very good. The Italian Yannick Sinner, who, despite his name, is in fact Italian. So now for this week's quiz questions, which are all about the month of July, and no singing out the answers this time. Number one is, for which Roman emperor is the month of July named? I can hear some whispering in the ranks. Question two, St. Swithin's Day falls on July 15th every year. According to British tradition, if it rains on this day, for how many days will it continually rain? And there's some hand signals going on in the room this time. Question three, who became the first black man to win the Wimbledon tennis singles title in July 1975? I can hear some whispering again. Question four, which item of beachwear famously went on sale for the first time in July 1946? And question five, Neil Armstrong became the first man to step on the moon on July 21, in which year? Answers next week. And now it's our notice board. A couple of musical events that might interest you. On Friday the 3rd of July, that's tomorrow as we're recording this, singer Paul Jones and friends appear at the Whitney Corn Exchange. It's described as an unmissable evening of rhythm and blues with the star of Manfred Mann and the Blues Band. The show starts at 7:30 and seats are mostly around £30. And on Saturday the 4th of July, Burford Orchestra presents a fairy tale themed summer concert at Burford School. They will perform music written by the likes of Humperdinck, not that one, Ravel and Tchaikovsky. It starts at 7:30 and tickets this time are just £10, and they're available in advance from www.burfordorchestra.org.uk. Now, there are no listeners with birthdays in the coming week, but there were seven deaths reported in the Gazette this week, some of which I also read out last week. They were Irene Coombs, née Dane, who died on the 8th of June, aged 86, Larry Green, who died on the 5th of June, also aged 86, Anthony, known as Tony Povey, of Carterton, who died on the 9th of June, aged 67. Richard Simpson, who died on the 10th of June, aged 82. David Soule died on the 7th of June, at the age of 87. And Elizabeth, or Betty Holmes, née Berryman, died on the 7th of April, at the age of 91. I'm not sure why that's only in the Gazette this week. But our condolences to family and to friends. We now start part two of our news items, and it's about an initiative to combat loneliness.
The headline is, Age UK warns of serious impact of loneliness. Older people can go a whole week without speaking to a single friend or family member. One in 40 older residents across Oxfordshire are affected, according to Age UK Oxfordshire, which highlighted the issue during Loneliness Awareness Week. The charity estimates that around 10,000 people aged 65 and over in the county are often lonely. Paul Ringer, chief executive of Age UK Oxfordshire, said, "Loneliness isn't always visible, and it isn't always about being by yourself. Many older people tell us they can still feel lonely even when they see people regularly. What really makes the difference is feeling genuinely connected, knowing someone cares enough to listen and take the time." The charity's campaign challenges the idea that loneliness is simply about being alone, emphasising instead the importance of feeling understood and valued by others. Research shows that loneliness can have a serious impact on both mental and physical health. Older people who experience loneliness are around 25% more likely to develop dementia. Prolonged loneliness is also linked to poor health outcomes and a lower quality of life.
I've got another story about RAF Brize Norton. Ceremony celebrates armed forces work. RAF Brize Norton's station commander raised the Armed Forces Day flag in Carterton, joined by representatives from Carterton Town Council, veterans and members of the local community. A ceremony recognised the contribution of serving personnel, reservists, veterans, cadets and families. Group Captain Louise Henton, station commander at RAF Brize Norton, said, "The raising of the Armed Forces Day flag is a visible demonstration of our pride to all those who serve, have served, and the families who support them. As the UK's principal air mobility hub, RAF Brize Norton remains committed to serving the nation at home and overseas, and this week provides an important opportunity to recognise the dedication, professionalism, and sacrifice of the entire armed forces community." It highlighted the strong and enduring relationship between RAF Brize Norton and the town of Carterton. And there's a photograph accompanying showing two very smartly dressed RAF personnel saluting the flag being raised by a member of the Carterton Town Council.
And now a proposal to issue fines for the pavement parkers. Parking wardens may soon be able to give out fines to drivers who park on the pavement, under plans that look increasingly likely to go ahead. Pavement parking will be debated by councillors on Oxfordshire County Council next week. Bethia Thomas, the council leader for the Vale of White Horse district, has put forward plans to the county to ban the method of parking. And pavement parking doesn't just mean leaving an entire car on the path, it can include leaving two wheels on the edge of the kerb too. Ms Thomas will say to the council that it causes significant danger, particularly to disabled people or those with mobility issues. Meanwhile, County Council Cabinet Member for Transport, Gareth Epps, has also backed a ban on pavement parking. Ms Thomas said the call for the civil enforcement officers to be given powers to enforce the policy is cost neutral to the council. If her motion is successful next Tuesday, council leader Tim Bearder will write to the local transport minister in Westminster asking for further resources to implement the ban. Mr Epps said, "I'm pleased that the government has given local government powers relating to pavement parking, and there have been calls for this for many years." In January, the Department for Transport said councils will be given new and improved legal control to make it easier to restrict pavement parking across wider areas. This is instead of relying on the previous approach, where action is often limited to individual streets and requires lengthy, complex processes, the government said. Local Transport Minister Lillian Greenwood explained that clear pavements are essential for people to move around safely and independently, whether that's a parent with a pushchair, someone using a wheelchair, or a blind or partially sighted person. RAC Senior Policy Officer Rod Dennis said pavement parking is a serious problem in some communities that needs tackling. He added, No pavement user should be forced into walking or wheeling into the road because of someone parking inconsiderately. A clear majority of drivers agree and want to see an end to needless pavement parking that causes accessibility problems.
And we finish with a story from the Chippy Norton News about the town's Antipodean twin. The headline is Chippo, Down Under, Air Australian links explored by Bill Williams. Summer visitors and recent Chippy residents may not know that in the suburbs of Sydney, New South Wales, in Australia, there is also a town called Chipping Norton. And if you ever pay a visit there, you'll find that the 9,000 citizens of that Chipping Norton are very aware of the connection with their own market town, which may in fact be a reason for their existence. This suburb of Sydney was named by William Alexander Long, 1839 to 1915, a prominent 19th century Australian politician and racehorse breeder who came briefly to study law in the UK in the 1860s, living for a short time at a private residence in Chippy, which he grew to love. Upon returning to Australia in the 1880s, he built a large property and horse stud, which he duly named Chippy Norton. It grew into a small town and eventually a suburb in the southwest of the city. In 1925, the Chippy Norton Stakes was introduced for thoroughbred horses at Randwick as a preparatory race for the Sydney Cup and continued until 2024. Today, the town, known as Chippy, still boasts a heritage-listed residence at the Charlton Avenue, which completed in 1893, known as the Chippy Norton Homestead, which William Long built on land that, prior to European settlement, was part of an ancient eucalyptus forest, which includes what is now known as the Chippy Norton Lakes.
Do you know, I didn't know that until I read it today about the other Chippy, and I lived in Sydney for a good number of years, so there we go. Well, that's it for this week's edition. Our thanks go to the Whitney Gazette and the Chipping Norton News for that most recent article and others we've used. Our readers have been Valerie T, Henry Spielberg, Valerie Palmer and Robert Buckingham, and our recording has been made possible by the chap beside me, Peter Brading. Our admin team were Nigel James and Marnie Leach, and it's Henry and I who will be copying and packing the memory sticks to send out to you. That's all for this week, but before we go, let's finish with a joke, as has become our new tradition. So it's this. My six-year-old daughter said she wanted a Cinderella-themed birthday party for her and her friends. So I told them all to dress up in rags and then I made them scrub the kitchen floor. So, keep listening at the end of our program for highlights of this week's best radio and TV watching. And I know that everyone here at Whitney Talking News would like to wish you well. And so until our next edition, we will all say goodbye.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, I'm David, and I'm bringing you some radio highlights for this coming week that I hope you will enjoy listening to in the days ahead. First of all, Saturday the 4th of July. Today's vintage comedy is Brothers-in-Law, a legal sitcom from 1970, starring Richard Briers and John Le Mesurier. On Radio 4 Extra at 9:30 a.m, repeated at 2:30 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. Radio 3's Essential History of Classical Music explores Johann Sebastian Bach's The Well-Tempered Clavier on Radio 3 at 1 p.m. And Radio 2 brings you Madonna and Graham, where Graham Norton and Madonna have an intimate and in-depth chat. And that's on Radio 2 at 6 p.m. Opera on 3 today is Bizet's Les Pêcheurs de Perles, or The Pearl Fishers. And you'll find that on Radio 3 at 6 p.m. And we couldn't pass over the 4th of July without something American. James Naughtie looks at how Americans celebrate the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence in Archive on 4, Born on the 4th of July, and that's on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. And Radio 4 brings you a comedy set in an Ulster parish council meeting. In Parish Matters, Don't Come Crying to Me When the Robots Take Over. And that's on Radio 4 at 11 p.m. And then for Sunday, the 5th of July, Sunday worship this morning comes from Hereford Cathedral on Radio 4 at 8:10 in the morning. Classic comedy today is a 1955 episode of Take It From Here, on Radio 4 Extra at 10:30 a.m, repeated at 3 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. Lauren Laverne's guest on Desert Island Discs today is the glaciologist Professor Liz Morris, and you can find that on Radio 4 at 10 a.m, repeated on Friday at 9 a.m. Radio 4 brings you the 1921 American play Anna Christie by Eugene O'Neill. And that's on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. And Desert Island Discs Revisited, Dame Ellen MacArthur talks to Kirsty Young about her solo circumnavigation of the globe. And that's on Radio 4 Extra at 5 p.m. And a further musical celebration of American independence is the Sunday feature A Musical Evening at Monticello, on Radio 3 at 7 p.m. In Later Life Letter, poet Luke Wright considers the letters written by social workers telling adopted children about their birth families, including his own experiences. And that's on Radio 4 at 7:15 p.m. And now for some programmes that are broadcast each weekday at the same time. Book of the Week this week is On Thin Ice, a memoir of Siberia, surveillance and survival by explorer and travel writer Charlie Walker. And that's on Radio 4 each day at 11:45 a.m. And then episodes 6 to 10 of 10 Fights That Made the Green Movement is on Radio 4 each day at 1:45 p.m. Radio 3's Composer of the Week this week is Fela Saunedi, the late Nigerian composer. And that's on Radio 3 each afternoon at 4 p.m. The essay Call of the Wild is on Radio 3 at 9:45 each evening. Operation Rex is a story of one boy's challenges that he faced in keeping his pet at the beginning of the Second World War. And that's on Radio 4 each evening at 10:45 p.m. Then Monday, the 6th of July, today's vintage comedy is a 1976 episode of Dad's Army. Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, repeated 12:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. In Reflections, James Naughtie talks to Jerry Brown, the former governor of California, on Radio 4 at 9:30 a.m. Classical Live on Radio 3 shines the spotlight on orchestras due to appear in this year's proms. Classical Live is on Radio 3 at 1 p.m. Radio 4 addresses the problem of artificial intelligence being used by students in place of building their argument in essays. In the Artificial University on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. And Radio 3 in Concert today brings you Bach's Mass in B minor with the BBC Singers on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday the 7th of July. A 1958 episode of The Goon Show is today's vintage comedy. Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m. repeated at 12:30 and 6:30 p.m. People Fixing the World is a programme about helping aspiring entrepreneurs to bring their ideas to life. And that's on the BBC World Service at 8:05 in the morning, repeated at 3:05 and 10:05 this afternoon and this evening. The Art of Isolation, Hikikomori Stories, exploring the world of socially isolated people on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. Radio 3 in Concert Today is a performance of Mahler's epic Resurrection Symphony, and that's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. To Catch a King follows an investigation into catching people smugglers on Radio 4 at 9 p.m. Wednesday the 8th of July, Hancock's Half Hour is today's vintage comedy from 1955, Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, 12:30 and 6:30 p.m. The Odyssey, a dramatisation of Homer's epic tale, is on Radio 4 Extra at 2:30 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. Choral Evensong on Radio 3 comes from the Parish Church of St John at Hampstead in London, and you can find that on Radio 3 at 3 p.m. Radio 3 in Concert tonight brings you a recorded performance of Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610, and that's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. And then Thursday, the 9th of July, I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again brings you a 1965 comedy episode at 7:30 a.m. and 12:30 and 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra. Who Do You Think We Were? National Remembrance of the 1924 Empire Exhibition, a series marking the 75th anniversary of the 1951 Festival of Britain, on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. In a new series of This Natural Life, Dame Judi Dench takes you on a tour of her woodland garden in Surrey, on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. And Radio 3 in Concert this evening comes from York Minster, in a concert devoted to Spanish choral music from the Renaissance. That's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. And then Friday the 10th of July, today's vintage comedy is a 1976 episode of Steptoe and Son. Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, 12:30 and 6:30 p.m. And Desert Island Discs today brings you a repeat of last Sunday's episode with Professor Liz Morris on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. Heart and Soul brings you the account of a Japanese man who lost his wife in the 2011 tsunami and who dives into the waters of Onagawa Bay twice a day in tribute to her. Heart and Soul is on BBC World Service at 1:30 p.m., repeated at 10:30 p.m. Limelight Central Intelligence is a drama about the CIA in 1964, as President Johnson fears that the communists might win the elections in Chile. Limelight Central Intelligence is on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. Friday night is Music Night, brings you a concert celebrating 75 years of the iconic BBC drama The Archers. And that's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. And that concludes my selection for this week. I do hope you have found it both helpful and entertaining.
Hello, this is Val from Wharfdale Talking News with my selection of audio-described TV programmes for the period Saturday the 4th to Friday the 10th of July 2026. Coverage of the Football World Cup and Wimbledon continues, and as mentioned last week, these events will probably affect the programme schedules on BBC One, BBC Two and ITV One, as live coverage will include extra time, and because it is still not known at this time which channels will cover which matches. Also, some of the programmes I have listed for these channels may not happen because of this uncertainty. This week's listings in the Radio Times also do not show any of the matches being audio described, so you will have to rely on the commentary to give you an idea of the action. So, having said all that, let's get started with Saturday, the 4th of July. The daytime schedules are taken up with mainly Wimbledon on the BBC channels. And also on ITV1, there is live coverage of Nations Championship Rugby Union, though not audio described, starting with New Zealand versus France, kickoff 10 past 8, Australia versus Ireland, kickoff 11:10 a.m., and Fiji versus Wales, kickoff 2:10 p.m. Today's daytime programmes on Channel 4 start with a double bill of The Simpsons at 10 a.m., Narrow Escapes featuring the maintenance work of the Canal and River Trust at 1 p.m., followed by Chateau DIY at 2 p.m. There are four episodes of Midsummer Murders on ITV3 today at 2 p.m, 4 p.m, 6 p.m, and 8 p.m. Coverage of World Cup Match of the Day Live is at 5:30 p.m, and another World Cup match starts at 10 p.m. tonight. Two films on Channel 4 tonight. At 6:30 p.m, the Oscar-winning blockbuster Titanic, followed at 10:15 p.m. by a sci-fi thriller, The Creator. The story of Captain James Cook's historic 1768 voyage is the subject of the documentary series Voyages of Discovery. The Making of Captain Cook is on BBC Four at 8 p.m. The film Downton Abbey, A New Era, is the late film on ITV One at 10:45 p.m. On to Sunday, the 5th of July. Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, featuring interviews with politicians and key public figures, is on BBC One at 9 a.m. Alan Titchmarsh and his green-fingered experts head to Essex in Love Your Garden on ITV One at 12:35 p.m. The afternoon film on ITV1 at 3:15 is the spy adventure You Only Live Twice, starring Sean Connery as James Bond. We revisit a couple from Croydon who have disagreed over the future of their unusual bungalow for the best part of a decade. Kirsty and Phil's Love It or List It, Brilliant Builds, is on Channel 4 at 6 p.m. Another chance to see how celebrities recreate their hometowns in show-stopping biscuit form in the Great Celebrity Bake Off for Stand Up to Cancer on Channel 4 at 7 p.m. The Agatha Christie mystery Murder on the Orient Express, starring Kenneth Branagh as Hercule Poirot, is tonight's film on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. Today's World Cup matches kick off at 9 p.m. and 1 a.m. Here are those programmes which are on at the same time throughout the week. On BBC One, a new series of Expert Witness starts at 10:45 a.m. Monday to Friday. Homes Under the Hammer is at 11:15 and Bargain Hunt is at 12:15 each day apart from Wednesday. On BBC One, live coverage of the tennis at Wimbledon starts at about 12:30 on Saturday and Sunday and continues throughout the week at 2 p.m, apart from an earlier start at 11:15 a.m. on Wednesday. Over on BBC Two, live coverage starts at 11 a.m. each day, apart from a later start at 1 p.m. on Wednesday. Although not audio described, the commentary should give you an idea of the action. And by the way, the tennis schedules could be changed depending on live coverage of the World Cup. On ITV1, Dickinson's Real Deal is only on Monday to Wednesday this week at 2 p.m. Monday and Wednesday and 2:15 on Tuesday. On Channel 4, there are four episodes of the sitcom Frasier starting at 9:10 each morning, Monday to Friday. On ITV3, there are two episodes of Heartbeat starting at 5:50 and 6:55 p.m. Monday to Friday. Now for the soaps. EastEnders will be on BBC One at 7 p.m. on Monday and on BBC Two at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday to Thursday. On ITV1, Emmerdale will be at 7:15 on Sunday and at 8 p.m. Wednesday to Friday. Coronation Street will be at 7:45 p.m. on Sunday and 8:30 on Wednesday and 9 p.m. Thursday and Friday. Now for Monday, 6th of July. Insurance investigator Catherine Zeta-Jones sets out to catch master thief Sean Connery in the romantic thriller Entrapment on Film 4 at 6:45 p.m. Port of Dover police investigate organised car theft gangs and a yacht disappears in treacherous seas. Dover 24/7, Britain's busiest port, is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. While we glug down millions of cups each year, how many of us know where our tea actually comes from? Find out as the adventurer heads to East Africa to uncover the secrets behind the UK's favourite drink. The Tea Trail with Simon Reeve is on BBC Four at 8 p.m. The historian examines the Doomsday Book and the Bayeux Tapestry to discover how William the Conqueror beat King Harold at the Battle of Hastings. 1066, Lucy Worsley Investigates is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. A new drama, Lie With Me, starts on Channel 5 tonight at 9 p.m. British woman Anna and her Australian husband Jake move to Melbourne with their children for a fresh start, where they hire a nanny, who isn't all she appears to be. Continues each evening until Thursday. Today's World Cup matches kick off at 8 p.m. and 1 a.m. On to Tuesday, the 7th of July. Today's World Cup matches kick off at 5 p.m. and 9 p.m. The comedy drama about the singing Cornish fisher folk is the early evening film on Film 4 at 6:50 p.m. In tonight's episode of Bake Off The Professionals on Channel 4 at 8 p.m, the six remaining teams compete for a quarter-final spot, with the senior development chef at Waitrose setting the pairs a retail product challenge. The death of a pensioner takes DCI Stanhope to a coastal town, but she faces a wall of silence from the residents. Vera is on ITV3 at 8 p.m. In this repeat of Grand Designs on Channel 4 at 9 p.m, Kevin MacLeod celebrates the 25th anniversary by revisiting the show's first ever project. In tonight's final episode of the documentary series The American Revolution on BBC Four at 10 p.m, the British Army under General Cornwallis struggles to pacify the southern states. Wednesday, the 8th of July. A 1940s drum kit is brought into the repair shop at 8 p.m. on BBC Two. A doctor and paramedic are dispatched to treat a woman who has suffered a cardiac arrest while driving. Ambulance Code Red is on Channel 5 at 8 p.m. Professor Brian Cox looks at the discoveries we have made to understanding how the universe came to be. Universe, The Big Bang Before the Dawn is on BBC Four at 8 p.m. Time for another visit to the Caribbean. When a pop singer is found dead at a rehab clinic, it looks like an accident, but Neville thinks there's more here than meets the eye. Death in Paradise is on BBC One at 9 p.m. A former financial trader looks at the growing wealth gap, including why he thinks it is the root of many of the UK's social and economic problems, and what he proposes we do about it. How to Get Filthy Rich with Gary Stevenson is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. Mark Evans tracks the exploits of more landlocked homeowners building a life in stunning aquatic homes. The new series, My Floating Home, starts on More 4 at 9 p.m. The late-night film on BBC One at 10:40 p.m. is the sci-fi thriller War of the Worlds, based on the H.G. Wells 1898 novel. On to Thursday, the 9th of July. The architect meets James, who has a budget of £500,000 to restore a former glassworks property. George Clark's Remarkable Renovations is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. A new series of the Marlowe Murder Club starts tonight on the U and Drama Channel at 8 p.m. In the first episode of this two-parter, Judith Potts' evening is shattered when she witnesses her neighbour's murder. Today's World Cup match, the first quarter-final, kicks off at 9 p.m. A drama documentary telling the story of Gordon Welchman, one of the elite team of codebreakers who proved critical to the Allied war effort, is the subject of Bletchley Park, Codebreaking's Forgotten Genius, on BBC Four at 9 p.m. Barrister Webster has something on his conscience he wants to confess to his carer before he dies. Find out more in How Do You Plead? From Series 6 of Inside Number 9 on BBC Two at 10 p.m. And so we come to Friday, the 10th of July. Our Lives, Ashington AFC, Saving Our Club on BBC One at 7 p.m. tells us about a group of volunteers who aim to keep their Northumberland Football Club afloat. Today's World Cup match, the second quarter-final, kicks off at 8 p.m. The Owens prepare for Clive's 70th birthday in our farm next door, Amanda, Clive and Kids, on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. More famous faces sit down to give their thoughts on the week's TV in Celebrity Gogglebox on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. The comedy drama Austin, starring Ben Miller and Sally Phillips, returns for a new series tonight on BBC One at 10 past 11. In the first episode, DNA test results reveal that Julian isn't Austin's father after all. The second episode follows at 11:40 p.m. We have two films to end the week. The crime thriller Jack Reacher, starring Tom Cruise and Rosamund Pike, on ITV1 at 10:45, and the period romantic drama Atonement on BBC Two at 12:05. Well, that's all for this week, and next time you hear me doing the TV listings, I think the World Cup will be over, and I hope there will be more choice for you.
TNF Soundings.